Mr. Mitchell.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. This matter involves a waiver of jury trial and arbitration agreement, an agreement that the plaintiffs admit was a separate signed agreement that they entered into at the time that they entered into an initial consumer loan agreement. The trial court acknowledged, finding in addition to the consumer loan agreement, these plaintiffs signed a provision requiring arbitration. However, the plaintiffs argue, and the trial court has found, that this waiver of jury trial and arbitration agreement applies only to the initial consumer loan agreement that was entered into and signed contemporaneous with that separate agreement.
In other words, there weren't any, but the trial court also, reading this paragraph, understood that it would apply to any prior agreements. And I think that word prior is a problem with your position, because the arbitration agreement defines the word dispute and disputes, and it says controversy arising from or related directly or indirectly to the applicant personal information form. That's the first thing. This agreement or any prior agreement or agreements between you and us. And that it's hard for me to read the word prior to mean subsequent also.
I understand it, but first of all, Your Honor, the paragraph 1 of the jury trial, waiver of jury trial and arbitration agreement, defines dispute, and it's a very broad definition.
That's what
prior agreement is one aspect of that, in addition to all claims in contract, tort, fraud. It's a mutual agreement by both parties, so it's got adequate consideration to stand on its own.
But why it says it's past, but it doesn't say future. I mean, that's the big word that's missing that's problematic for you.
And I understand that. I understand that.
That kind of ends the day, doesn't it? I mean, if that word dispute is interpreted as only past and current, then you're out the door.
Well, I guess if you take the all claims between the parties and limit it to just the past, it doesn't even necessarily say the present contract that's being entered into. The trial court here essentially relies on this court's holding in Matterhorn, which is similar to this. It involved a universal arbitration agreement that I don't believe that it's disputed that such a universal arbitration agreement can exist or be valid. In Matterhorn, this court found that when looking at the whole course of conduct between the parties, there was something in that subsequent transaction that said maybe the parties didn't mean for that universal arbitration agreement to apply. That's not the case here. We have I'm going to call it a universal agreement. It doesn't use that terminology in its title. It's a waiver of jury trial and arbitration agreement for all disputes between the parties.
Even know there's likely to be? I mean, there may never be another contract again between these people 30 years from now. You know, the person who owns Instant Cash may run into her car. It seems to me a very unreasonable reading of this language that you've appended to your brief to assume without some signal that it's supposed to be that perpetual an agreement, that it isn't better to look at it in terms of the context of the agreement. It's dated on a certain date. It's it's contemporaneous with this 7/12/2000 in terms of the Sheila Smith agreement, the one I'm looking at right now. It's a 7/12/2000 loan. The word prior or this agreement is used, and certainly anything, if she slips and falls, as you said, fine, covered. You know, when she walks back in to repay, but to say it's eternal, is really quite a statement.
Well, and I'm not sure if I would argue necessarily that it's eternal.
Well, where's the limit then, under your theory?
Well, I think the limit is when you look at, as the court in Matterhorn did, the course of conduct between the parties. If Ms. Smith had come in and taken out a loan and 30 years later there's an auto accident, I think that she has a very strong argument that this arbitration agreement would not apply to that.
What is the criteria? Yeah. So you're interpolating the term. What is that term?
I'm looking at the course of conduct between the parties. I'm looking
reasonable
at the
reasonable time or what?
Yeah. What rule are you going to give us? What rule would you like us to adopt that we could apply in other cases?
Somewhere between
disagreement and 30 years out. Because you said 30 years out, it wouldn't probably apply. So, I mean, what rule can you give up?
I don't know if there's a steadfast rule that the court. Well, I think if we look at the facts of this particular case, we have in Ms. Smith's case, she takes out a loan on 7/12 of 2000. The next loan agreement that is in the record is dated August 15th of 2000. Referring to that loan agreement, it references that loan is repaying a loan that was prior to that loan agreement. I think that there's a decent assumption that it occurred in between the 7/12 agreement and the 8/15 agreement, particularly in light of the plaintiff's allegations in the complaint that these type of short-term loans are frequently extended or rolled over based on... I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Right, but I understand what you were saying. They are frequently, but I thought it was your position that each one of these notes was a fully legally enforceable standalone note.
I believe that they are, Your Honor, and I believe that this arbitration agreement applies as a blanket agreement to each one of those notes.
What section within the arbitration agreement are you relying on? A, B, C, D, E, F?
I think number one, you can look
there's
to.
No E.
If you look to paragraph two, it says
what's
that.
Paragraph two. You know, that's what I'm. That's the one that says for purposes of this agreement.
That's
no,
paragraph
two, Your Honor, says except as provided in four, all disputes
shall be resolved
by bargaining arbitration. Then you go back to paragraph one to look
right,
for the definition
right.
of dispute.
Yes, exactly. That's what I'm asking you. So which is the what subsection of one is are you relying on?
It makes it the blanket.
Oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
See, I thought you were relying on C, all common law claims based upon contract tort, fraud, and other intentional torts, which is why I asked my 30-year out question, because if there's my car accident in 30 years, that's a tort claim, among many other things, perhaps. It's a regular old tort claim, and I don't see why you aren't willing to say that C covers that accident.
I think if you look at the nature of the relationship between the parties, this arbitration agreement is entered into at the time a consumer loan agreement
exactly.
is entered into.
Exactly,
and so the course of
the word prior agreement. You could have had her sign one of these along, you know, just shove what, she would have signed anything. Shove whatever piece of paper under her hand and she would have signed it, but you didn't.
Well,
and this rollover language is not included. It would have been a very simple matter to add some rollover language in that paragraph. You know, any additional agreement signed relating to this loan, some language to that effect would have taken care of it.
Certainly, and hindsight in contract drafting to provide in a blanket agreement for every possible circumstance that could come up would
well,
certainly be ideal.
Answer my question. What subsection of one are you relying on?
I would rely not only on C, which says all common law claims, but also on E, which says all claims asserted by you against us, including claims.
But don't B through F refer back to A? Aren't they just ways of saying that whatever the ground, whatever the procedural posture, whatever the form and so on, if it's a dispute arising out of an agreement mentioned in A, then it's, because you surely don't mean that some, you know, the slip and fall is actually covered by this. You wouldn't make that ridiculous argument, would you?
You know, no, I probably would not.
No, you wouldn't. So B through F relate back to A, right?
I don't know, because...
I don't understand. Because A is the one that says disputes arising out of agreements between you and the borrower. If it doesn't arise out of an agreement between you and a borrower, how could it possibly be comprehended by the arbitration agreement? Give me an example of a dispute that doesn't arise out of an agreement between you and the borrower, but nevertheless is subject to this compulsory arbitration.
Potentially an act that the borrower takes at the business place during the loan origination process.
Like what? Punches one of the loan officers in the face? Is that what you have in mind?
Very possibly. Or vice versa.
Personal injury is within the arbitration agreement? That doesn't make any sense at all.
I see that my time is out, Your Honor. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Mitchell. Mr. Shepherd?
May it please the Court, my name is Clifford Shepherd. I represent the plaintiffs in the action below. As a consequence of the Court's cogent questioning, about 5 minutes of my argument have been eliminated, so I will cut right to my conclusion. We agree with Judge Hamilton that if the Cash to Go wanted to ensure arbitrability of any claims that may later arise subsequent to the execution of the arbitration agreement, it could have made so by unmistakable express representation. And I would like to offer some alternatives that could have followed if they had wanted to ensure arbitrability. It's one thing to armchair quarterback what they did wrong, but I would suggest that by showing what they could have done in order to obtain the benefits that they now seek from this court, it would have been a simple matter of legal draftsmanship. They could have incorporated, by reference, the arbitration agreement into the consumer loan agreement by a simple reference. Incorporated by reference into this consumer loan agreement is the application that you signed at the inception of your relationship with this company. They could have also simply put the arbitration agreement language or some summary thereof into the actual consumer loan document that the consumer takes out at the inception of either a rollover or a loan 3 months down the road.
Now, Mr. Shepherd, I agree with you that there are a number of things they could have done, but don't you think that if you win this case, it'll be a bit of a Pyrrhic victory, that they'll just go back and change their arbitration agreements and henceforth people won't be able to bring these kinds of usury claims and other sorts of things in court?
I do feel that I'm extending the noose around our own client's neck. But, Your Honor, the cat's been out of this bag for a long time. It was August 16th of 2001 that the Livingston case came from the Indiana Supreme Court. Thereafter, a flurry of activity was undertaken by clever defense lawyers in our circuit in order to get these cases out of court, because the Indiana Supreme Court, which the federal district court must rely on in interpreting these agreements, was pretty clear. These loans are void, usurious, they constitute loan sharking. As a consequence, any payday lender that was still in business after our case came out scuttled quickly to lawyers to get these arbitration agreements drafted.
Now, could I ask you this? I understand that that's the process, but it raises to me an interesting question that's sort of left open in the Supreme Court's decision in Mitsubishi against Solar Chrysler Plymouth, namely, it's fine to compel arbitration up front, but the court has a footnote in Mitsubishi that says, but there's another phase, which is recognition and enforcement of an arbitral award. Now, I'm sure some Indiana arbitrators and some AAA arbitrators can read Indiana law as well as the next person and might follow the Indiana Supreme Court and refuse to enforce these agreements. Arbitrators can do that. There might be the occasional arbitrator who, for whatever reason, you know, mistakes what the law is or isn't paying attention or what have you, and doesn't. Do you think a court would enforce an arbitrator's award enforcing this agreement if the Indiana Supreme Court wouldn't?
I would be stunned to see a court enforce an award that is so blatantly contrary to clear, unequivocal Indiana Supreme Court law. I suppose it could happen, and that's one of the reasons that we take such a strict, recurring attack on any arbitration agreement that has the slightest loophole that can be exploited to deny arbitrability of the claims that arise thereunder.
You just don't want to run the risk of having to fight it out at the recognition and enforcement stage.
We're much happier to be in the district courts with their clever law clerks and the assistance they have, and plus the superior expertise they have in reviewing these types of
well,
matter.
What relief are you seeking in this case?
Your Honor, we pose this as a class action, a putative class action.
I don't know about that, yeah. Yeah, and what happened?
The action was stayed in part, except as to those claims to Ms. Hicks and Ms. Smith, whose claims were not found to have been bound by the arbitration agreement. However, in reality, the case has been sitting since, I believe, May 22, when the decision came out denying in part and granting in part the defendant's motion to compel arbitration.
So is it your idea that if we were to affirm, you would then ask for class action, for class certification? Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that we have all the grounds necessary to move for certification of the claims that are represented by Ms. Hicks and Ms. Smith and move forward with those. And then
and you're suing under RICO, I think, and what else?
The Fair Debt Collection Practices Act is a claim that's premised against the attorney debt collector. This is the individual lawyer who sought to collect on the defaulted checks that were tendered as security agreements.
Oh, I see. So that's why the lawyers are the defendants here, yeah.
Yes, Your Honor. The racketeering is actually an incorporation by reference, to use that term again, of Indiana law, which defines loan sharking as the making or collection of a loan at twice the legal rate. It provides a much broader period of limitations than that found within the UCCC. So upon successfully moving for class certification, we would seek damages premised upon the longer statute under RICO and the trebling, automatic, mandatory trebling of the damages thereunder. And additionally, we would be stepping into the iron-shuttered waters of moving for arbitration on the uncertifiable claims of Mr. Bryant and Mr. Kelly. And to finalize my small litany of things they could have done, and probably will do in the future, they could have simply defined dispute without the additional superfluous language of prior agreements. If they had simply stopped when they said all disputes, period, that would have been that. If they felt compelled in some manner to go forward with describing what disputes mean, they could have said something as prior disputes, subsequently occurring disputes, those accruing hereafter, those which may arise in the future, whether known or unknown, inchoate or incomplete, existing now, or which occur or accrue hereafter. And this is all language that we've seen by way of these arbitration agreements where they try to ensure, the absolute blanketing of every conceivable situation that may accrue, whether prior to the agreement being made or which may occur thereafter. What it appears defendants are trying to do now is obtain a revision to their contract, which Indiana law, which of course is used to determine the applicability and enforceability of these contracts, simply does not allow. And for those reasons, we would ask the court to affirm in all respects Judge Hamilton's ruling.
You said the Indiana Supreme Court had invalidated these payday loans as usurious. Has anyone argued unconscionability in any of this litigation, that these are contracts of adhesion and they're just so one-sided that it's unreasonable to enforce them?
Somewhere in the approximate 40 class actions that we were on with the Edelman and Combs law firm, we did argue a variety of unconscionability theories, whether premised upon common law or upon the provision within the Uniform Consumer Credit Code pertaining to unconscionable agreements.
Right.
I can't state a specific case. We had more than three dozen of these, plus a
slew
of individual.
There are no appellate decisions dealing with the unconscionability question.
None that I'm aware of, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Mr. Mitchell, how much time does he have? No time? Would you like a minute for rebuttal?
The only response that I would make, Your Honor, is the language of the waiver of jury trial and arbitration agreement says all disputes. What we have now is a court that has taken upon itself to limit that language to any dispute that is not specifically stated within the contract. The drafter of the contract came up with prior agreements between the parties and did not discuss future agreements. That does not necessarily limit this or take away from the fact that it covers all disputes between the parties.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Torture me anymore. Okay, last